You know ID in the D in the L okay. ID in the D in the F E A. You know ID in the D in the L okay. ID in the D in the F E A.
Hello and welcome to a special episode of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton,
and I'm Tristan Carcino,
and we are joined this week to discuss the Seahawks 38-25 season opening win over the Atlanta Falcons by our live show guest last year, who sadly the show was after his bedtime this year. He couldn't make it, so we had to bring him on later this weekend. Please welcome back to the show from The Athletic Seattle, Ben Baldwin.
And what better way to come back than after the Seahawks scored 38 points in one game? Very, very good to be back on.
Opening question here is, have the nerds won?
It sure seems like it. I kind of made a joke after Andy Reid went for a 4th-and-1 in a close game on, I think it was his own like 35 or something. And I was like, I wonder if the Seahawks will go for 4th downs now. Ha ha ha. And then they go for this 4th-and-5 and throw a bomb to DK Metcalf for a touchdown. So that plus all the passing, definitely signs are pointing up for the nerds after a long time of not that.
Pointing up for the nerds. I said a couple of weeks ago that one of my favorite things to do was admitting that I was wrong. And I'm so hyped to admit that I'm wrong after this game. And I think one of the main reasons that I was wrong about this one was I did not expect the Seahawks team to look so similar, yet slightly so different. And I think if you ask yourself the question of what are the things from last year's Seahawks season that we would have liked to have seen differently, they basically would have been, we would have liked to have seen more passing in general, especially more passing on early downs, which we saw here. We would have liked to have seen more nickel be played and less base defense. We would have liked to have seen more pre-snap motion. And I think we hit kind of all of those different points in this game.
Yep, for sure. The pre-snap motion was noticeable. I think on the very first play of the game, they had this kind of jet motion. And unfortunately, it was a boot that the Falcons were expecting, so it ended in a sack. But at least it was like, okay, they're kind of doing what people want them to. And there was more of that as the game went on, and it worked better on most other plays than that first play. But after that first play, I was like, oh no, they tried to come out passing and they got sacked, and they're just going to go back to what they're comfortable doing. But to their credit, they really didn't. And they really unleashed Russ for almost the whole game.
Now I'm going to quibble with one thing Tristan said, which is that we did not see more nickel this year. I mean, we probably saw somewhat more nickel. We'll see when the actual stats come out, but what we saw was a lot more dime defense.
There we go.
Pete Carroll pivoted the entire opposite end of the spectrum from, you know, 4 defensive backs on the field at all times to now 6 defensive backs. Let's go, in a big dime at that.
Yeah, and I don't know how effective it was. The Falcons basically marched up and down the field the entire game, and the only time the Seahawks really got stops was stopping the Falcons on 4th down. And it's great that those happened. If the opponent goes 0-for-4 on 4th downs, then you probably have a good chance of winning the game. But I'm guessing the Falcons did not punt very often, and there's a lot of question marks about the Seahawks defense. One of them was the pass rush, and that did not look good. But if Seattle's offense is this good, then the defense only needs to be okay to either stay in games or win comfortably like they did today.
Atlanta punted twice in this game, which I'm told is twice more than the Colts punted.
Yeah, I was trying to catch up on what happened in the early games, and I'm having a really hard time digesting that game and the Jaguars and the Eagles somehow losing in D.C., so there's a lot of crazy stuff that happened already.
There was just so much sports going on this morning. There was an NBA playoff game where the Denver Nuggets were staving off elimination in 4-seed Game 7. The Seattle Storm were playing during the final hour of the Seahawks game against the Las Vegas Aces in a game they lost to end up the number 2 seed going into the WNBA playoffs. But still plenty of attention to be focused on the Seahawks. And let's hone in, I think, on the question of the run-pass balance, because I think that's ultimately probably the biggest factor. No matter what, and we're told a lot of things about what letting Russ cook entails by color analysts and radio hosts, etc. If I were to boil it down, I suppose I should let Ben do this. I think the number one thing would be pass more frequently on early downs, particularly on second and 10.
Yeah, that's right. And yeah, both first down and on second and long, you should be passing a lot because those are the two biggest times when passing has the biggest advantage relative to rushing. Looking at this game, the Seahawks had 50 plays on first and second down, and they ran on 32 of them, which is 64%, which I think would be maybe like in the non-Chiefs teams. The Chiefs are definitely an extreme in passing on early downs, but among the other teams, I think that would have been close to leading the league last year. So it's definitely what the Nerds were asking for, and Wilson looked pretty good doing it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there was a couple issues in terms of protection in the early going of this game. You mentioned the opening play. It started with that. He was sacked three times early. But Russ was, when he got the ball out, nearly perfect. 31 of 35 in this game. And an interesting stat that Zach Whitman originally retrieved from my ESPN coworker, Seth Walder, 0 of his 35 pass attempts today were thrown into a tight window, meaning less than 1 yard of separation per at Next Gen Stats. Entering today, the most passes in a game without a tight window throw was 30 by Derek Carr last season against the LA Chargers. That stat has been tracked since 2016. So that's, you know, it's very telling that it's different because, you know, historically, one of the reasons Russell Wilson has been so great statistically is this incredible completion percentage over expected that relies, at least in the Next Gen Stats version of that model, in part on the fact that he tends to be throwing to receivers with limited separation.
Incredible. I mean, and definitely a testament to where this receiving core is getting to. I think also just maybe the Falcons game plan of, I don't think they expected the Seahawks to let Russ cook coming into this game. I mean, there was this chatter early in Russell Wilson's career about how Pete was going to take Russ to masterclass, right? And that is exactly what this performance was. I mean, watching it, you just had to marvel that we get the chance to watch Russell Wilson on a week-to-week basis. Of those four incompletions, I mean, at least one of them was a wide-open drop to DK Metcalf. Yep. The fact that this could have been an even better performance, there were no near-miss interceptions. There was really nothing like that.
I mean, two of them were tips.
This was one of the perfect quarterback games we've ever seen.
Yeah, he completed 88.6% of his passes, which is a lot. The next-gen stats expected completion percentage site says his expected completion percentage was 75%, so that goes back to him having extremely advantageous situations to throw into. That's basically tied for third of the weekend behind Gardner Minshew, which I still don't understand what happened in that game.
Where he completed 21 of 22 in that one, right?
He completed 95% of his passes and he was expected to complete 79% of them. So like he still completed more than expected. Mahomes was at 78% and we saw him throwing to wide open receivers all throughout that game on Thursday night. And then right up there with them is Russell Wilson at 75%. So it's not just that he was making throws. It's that he was also having easy throws to make, which is something that the Seahawks have not provided him a lot. And part of that is probably throwing on early downs where we know that it is easier to throw. And also we haven't talked about the offensive line, but they have three new starters. And that was probably the biggest question mark about how the offense would look. And they weren't perfect. And I think it was his second sack was them not picking up that stunt on Grady Jarrett, but they were not terrible. And with Russell Wilson and those receivers, then not terrible is probably good enough for really good offense.
Agreed. And the other thing about this is, you know, I think they managed to get the ball out pretty quickly a lot of the game, particularly in the scripted part and then in the second half when they really caught a rhythm, which is, you know, what we've historically seen from the Seahawks offense. It's just that this time they had actually scored some touchdowns before they caught that rhythm in the second half and were leading the game.
Yeah, it's a really hard position for Seahawks opponents to be in when the Seahawks are ahead in the second half, because it seems like the Falcons were probably expecting them to run for good reason based on their history, but they just kept on coming out throwing on early downs, and rather than just try to run out the clock, they were aggressive in moving the ball down the field and putting up more points on the board. And it's a good thing they did, because the Falcons offense also looked pretty good, but again, credit to the Seahawks. This looked so different than the game against the Falcons last year, where they got this early lead and then kind of did absolutely nothing in the second half and just kind of hung on for dear life. I think Wilson had 20 pass attempts in that game, and this game was just completely different, where they looked like the better team and the dominant team, and they put their foot down on the Falcons and just kind of kept the lead throughout the game.
I think that was definitely one of the most exciting parts of the game also, is this, it didn't look like the Seahawks of the past. We've seen games year after year after year where there's an early lead and they sort of frittered away and it becomes a one possession game. This ended up being, you know, there was a cheap touchdown to get it to be a two possession game, which was something that we have not seen that often. You know, most of the time this is, it's 10 and they score and there's a chance to come back. But like, the Falcons needed some two garbage time touchdowns to even keep it this close. The fact that, you know, the last touchdown where they passed quite a bit on that last drive, I thought was especially exciting because it sort of pointed toward this is, we don't know what we'll see for the rest of the season. So far, this is a little bit of no holds barred Pete and Brian Schottie, right? Like this was them unleashing Russ more than we've almost ever seen Russ be unleashed throughout an entire game.
In particularly a game where they were leading basically the entire time. I don't think they ever, I guess they trailed 3-0 on their opening possession. That would be the one time in this game that they trailed. So yeah, so we've seen some games like this, but it's usually like, you know, Pittsburgh takes a lead and is throwing for a bunch of yards, or, you know, whatever game you want to pick, the Houston Deshaun Watson game, they take an early lead. And that's when Russ cooks. In this case, it was Russ cooking from the start. So let's go through this game a little bit, drive by drive.
Well, I want to talk one thing more generally, and that's the rushing attack. So I guess both the individuals who had the carries, but also just in general, you know, we're talking about they gave Russ a chance to cook. And granted, Atlanta had way more just plays in general, but the fact that Atlanta out-carried the Seahawks in this game is shocking. In a game that you mentioned that they led basically the entire way, comfortably for a lot of it. Like, that is the recipe for success that people talk about when they cite how many rushing attempts teams who win have. This is like this is your textbook team ran the ball more but was successful passing type of game. And in the end, the Seahawks ran the ball 20 times and the Falcons ran the ball 21 times, despite the fact that they were losing basically the entire game. The Seahawks really didn't, at no point did they say, we're going to pound the rock and run clock, even when they very well could have. But I thought more surprising was just who is getting those carries out of the backfield. You know, I think we would have expected it basically to be like, let's say 60-70% Carson, another chunk Carlos Hyde, and maybe a carry from somebody like Travis Homer or DJ Dallas. But to see a relatively even distribution between Hyde and Carson, Carlos Hyde actually out-carried Chris Carson in this one, and then three carries for Travis Homer was surprising for me.
Yeah, I guess the one caveat there is the six pass targets for Chris Carson, so he was definitely getting work in other ways and actually had a really nice one-handed catch and looked good in the passing game. But yeah, the actual distribution of rush attempts was not like if we were told before the game that the Seahawks would be ahead basically the whole game and Chris Carson only had six carries, we would have assumed that he got injured or something.
Yes, very much so. Look, they, and by they I mean Ben, said don't throw the ball to running backs, but Chris Carson, six catches and six targets, 45 yards, two touchdowns, some successful screens from the Seahawks to Chris Carson. It's something like they had managed to do at times last year with Rashad Penny, but the Carson screen game, I don't feel like it's ever worked this well before.
Yeah, and that the touchdown, the second touchdown he had, he basically caught the screen and just followed people into the end zone, and it was like, it's just, it was a bizarre experience as a Seahawks fan watching the Seahawks successfully do that.
It's supposed to work that way, I think. That's as I understand it. So if we go to back to the start of this game, at the very start, Todd Gurley running all over the Seahawks defense on the first two plays of the game, picking up 20 yards. A strange flashback to seeing Todd Gurley on the other side being successful in the early, I guess, some of the earlier middle days with the Rams.
Yeah, and then after that Matt Ryan also, he had a couple of deep passes and like with a million years in the pocket and everything that we were worried about, the Seahawks defense looked like it might be coming true.
I mean, definitely, like, I guess, I don't know if we want to get into this right now or save this for later, but like one of the thoughts coming into the season that we've discussed and you've written about is, you know, the Seahawks are taking this approach that turns out to be analytically backed, that they're investing more in their coverage than in their pass rush. But in this game, the pass rush looked pretty impressive with some creative doses of Jamal Adams and some nickel corner blitzes from Marquise Blair, and the pass coverage was extremely shaky.
Yeah, that's the issue with pass coverage is if you have one weak link, then it doesn't matter how good everybody else is. A team can exploit that link. So if you have Julio Jones matched up against whoever was playing cornerback on the right side, then like that was just a matchup that the Falcons were going to win. And like Jamal Adams is great and Quandre Diggs is really good. And he didn't always look like it today, but Shaquille Griffin is pretty good. But if the Seahawks don't have a plan for cornerback on the other side, then like even the investments in coverage, if you're going to invest that hard in coverage and have a weak link, then it kind of seems a bit pointless.
I mean, I think if you're being optimistic, Quentin Dunbar had limited practice time because of his late start to training camp. Then he had to leave for a funeral of a friend, or just a funeral. And, you know, hasn't had a lot of opportunity out there. It was in question whether he was even going to start until up until game time, I guess. We did see some Trey Flowers out there, but it was mostly Quentin Dunbar, and the Falcons did manage to pick on him with Julio Jones early in this game. But this drive, it stalled out a bit when they were 2nd and 5 at Seattle 32, and we got a play. It took a while, but LJ Collier flashed. He made a play unblocked off the edge, forced the intentional grounding on Matt Ryan that put them in 3rd and 16. The Seahawks were able to get a stop, and that was one fourth down the Falcons did not go for, settling for a Younghoe Koo field goal. LJ Collier back.
Back. Does that implies that he was
here?
Yeah.
Present.
The Seahawks take the ensuing kickoff, and this is the drive where we see a lot of Chris Carson in the passing game. Also, notably, a 15-yard completion to Tyler Lockett on 2nd and 19 after Russ was sacked on that opening play where the misdirection did not misdirect the Falcons whatsoever, and Tack McKinley sacked Russ. A third down pickup to Greg Olsen on 3rd and 4, and then they were moving. Did not face another third down until the 3rd and 23 at midfield, a huge pass interference call drawn by Tyler Lockett in a situation where, if I recall correctly, Tristan chatted that he expected a draw.
Yeah, and kudos to the Seahawks, maybe the new Seahawks, at least for 1 week, where they actually went for it and threw past the sticks on third down. And turns out that when you throw deep on 3rd and long, then sometimes something good might happen.
The first of those fourth down attempts for Atlanta came on a drive where they had a 28-yard completion to Jones with Dunbar in coverage. Then they faced they got to 3rd and 1 at the Seahawks 38. That's where they went with Brian Hill, their backup running back, instead of Gurley. He's dropped in the backfield by a 2-yard loss. Wagner was the first one there, officially credited to Bobby and Jamal Adams, both on that tackle. It's now 4th and 3. They decide to go for that one, and it's an incomplete pass, getting the Seahawks off the field. This time, they really waste no time. It's a 3-play drive, including Russell Wilson on I don't even quite know how to describe it, but Tyler Lockett running that circle motion around him in the backfield is the pitch option. Carson going the other direction on the misdirect. Russ keeps it and picks up 19 yards, although it's one of the rare times where he runs the ball and gets tackled outside of the fourth quarter.
Yeah, he just totally fooled the Falcons defender. And there's a great tweet from your ESPN colleague, Seth Walder, who didn't see the play and tweeted out the dots and was trying to make sense of the play. it just looks absurd watching the Falcons dots like just repel from Russell Wilson.
That's incredible. And a play, one of those types of plays where you're like, this is something they can use to set it up farther down the season. Also, if there's going to be a little bit of an option in the playbook, maybe one time a game, maybe he pitches it sometimes, maybe it's a Russ keep another time. It's one of those plays where you're like, okay, this we can come back to now that this is on film.
The Seahawks paid that off with a touchdown, the second receiving touchdown by Chris Carson shortly thereafter. So they lead 14-3. Atlanta comes back and marches the ball downfield. A 75-yard drive capped off by Todd Gurley going over the top for a touchdown. Younghoe Koo missed the extra point on that one. So it's 14-9 Seahawks. And then this was the stretch where the Seahawks offense, we did see some shades of 2019, maybe like 2019 at home against the Cardinals. Three plays and out on the Travis Homer series where he carries for no gain, 3-yard completion, and then Russ is sacked on 37.
Are you seeing this Kyler run, by the way, to put the Cardinals up?
No, I'm not watching it.
Oh, here we go. Kyler Murray, like 20-plus yard touchdown run to put the Cardinals up. There we go. carry on with the Seahawks.
It was after this that we got the monologue from Seth Walder about – I'm retweeting Seth's tweet. We got the monologue from Mark Schlereth. They have very different takes. I want to see his takes about letting Russ cook. And it's like, man, they ran on first down, threw to a running back on second down, and then he got sacked on third down. And that is the exact opposite of what we're talking about here.
Literally a pass attempt to Mark Schlereth, right? I have that right? To Mark Schlereth is being considered letting Russ cook in this scenario. And I think that this is one of the things about the whole let Russ cook, which I think we should come back to at the end. People just don't really understand what it means. And what they ended up doing here today, I think, is what we're looking for with letting Russ cook, which is like we talked about at the beginning, the passing on early downs, just not telegraphing everything that you're doing in the game. That's letting Russ cook. It's not just like I don't think anybody is specifically saying the Seahawks should pass every single down, although that would be fine. But it's more about putting Russell Wilson as the elite level quarterback that he is in advantageous situations to pass instead of forcing him to do it as difficult as possible. This is the type of performance you get, which we did see Schlereth come back to a couple other times later in the game. But if you look at this performance, this 31-for-35 with 300 plus passing yards, I don't think you can really put together a dialogue about not letting Russ cook after this.
I'm sure people will try.
Yeah, no, it's not going to stop anyone.
When he was passing a lot early in the game, I was thinking, like, how important it was that this would turn out to be successful, because, like, you can imagine where there's a situation where they come out throwing a lot, and just because football is a high-variant sport, it didn't work out, and then they never try it again, kind of like they did in 2018. So
yeah.
I'm hoping this is positive reinforcement for the coaching staff.
Do you think that there is a bigger disconnect between sort of the talking head announcers around the NFL? Obviously, there's a massive disconnect between the internet dialogue about the sport and these broadcasters. But do you think there's almost starting to be a disconnect between the teams themselves and the broadcasters now? I mean, you mentioned seeing, you know, you've got Frank Reich, the Colts not punting the entire game. You've got the Chiefs going for it so aggressively. I mean, you have coaches like Dan Quinn going for it four times. The Seahawks throwing deep on fourth down, DK Metcalf. Like, all of a sudden, and this has been one single week, so we don't judge it too much, but it is a trend that's been continuing throughout the NFL over the years. Teams are passing more and getting more aggressive every single year. Do you think that the conversation in the booth will ever catch up to that?
I think it'll be slow, and we have examples from a lot of other sports to draw on here. So it took baseball a long time to catch up to the kind of statistical revolution. We have Jeff Van Gundy complaining about three-pointers and whatever teams are doing now, even now. So, the people who are calling these games are, like, they came up in a very different NFL where the, like, quote-unquote numbers people didn't really have much of a say in anything. And, like, it'll there aren't that many people who have an open mind enough to kind of change their opinions on that. And Chris Collinsworth is probably the one shining example of someone who's done that. But for these like random Sunday afternoon games on Fox, where we have largely former players and people who have been around the game for a very long time, then the commentary is probably not going to match how the internet thinks, for sure, and even to some extent how teams think.
Tend to agree with that, yeah. So we did have one decision where Pete could have been a bit more aggressive. They faced a 4th-and-2 at their own 45 on that following drive after an incomplete pass to DK Metcalf on 3rd-and-2. That was the play where there was a lot of contact at the line of scrimmage. He was a little late coming out of his break, and the throw ended up low as a result. That would have been a highly aggressive move, certainly, for the Seahawks to go for it on their own side of the field. But that is the kind of situation, as you mentioned, Andy Reid going for it on Thursday Night Football.
Yeah, the Andy Reid's was, I think it was less than a yard, so it's not quite the same, but still, like, 4th-and-2 at midfield with 4 minutes left, you think about the upside of converting, where if you do, then you have a decent shot to run out the clock and possibly score, so there's certainly a lot of upside there. So, like, if I were making the decision, I would have gone for it, but I'm also much more aggressive than an NFL head coach would be, and I'm not the one who has to answer to media, so easy for me to say, but luckily it didn't turn out to bite them in the end of this half, at least.
Yeah, they got the ball at pretty much the same spot. They ended up again at 3rd-and-6 at their own 44, a 1 yard pass to Travis Homer, and ended up punting from precisely the same spot, the 45 on 4th-and-5. Atlanta ends up marching the ball down the field and gets a Younghoe Koo 49-yard field goal to make it 14-12 at halftime. And at this point, like, you know, first off, the Seahawks have a lead at halftime. That's an upgrade on a lot of situations last season. But still, you're feeling a little iffy, because I think one of the questions we had is, okay, there was a lot of exciting stuff. There was a lot of pre-snap motion, a lot of passing in the scripted plays. But once they got out of those original 15 scripted plays, was that going to be able to continue? I think that was my question at this point.
Yeah, and also, how are they going to behave if they have a sizable lead in a game? And the second quarter was not an encouraging start there.
But the third quarter was a different story. And this is where that big fourth down decision came. They were 4th-and-5 at the Atlanta 38, kind of in no man's land there. Too long for a Jason Myers field goal, too short to punt. Almost no choice but to go for it, although that has not stopped Pete Carroll at times in the past. And that's where Russ throws deep and finds DK Metcalf. As Schlereth put it, I thought this was well done. You could not have, like, walked and handed it to DK Metcalf any better than he delivered that. There's nothing better in pro sports right now than the camera panning deep after Russell Wilson has passed.
Yeah, and Metcalf just solidly beat his guy, got position behind him, and then from there it was just a matter of running full speed and putting his arms out, and there was the ball and the touchdown.
So that put the Seahawks ahead 21-12. They then benefit Atlanta, another fourth down decision. They fake a punt on 4th-and-2 at their own 33. It worked, actually, but Marquise Blair coming up huge forces the fumble after the Falcons ball carrier had crossed the line to gain the first down line, and Freddie Swain comes up with the recovery at the Atlanta 36.
Yeah, until you said that, I forgot they actually converted the first down first. So it's kind of funny that it doesn't count as a fourth down conversion because they actually fumbled, but good for Blair and Swain.
Yeah, Swain active in part because Philip Dorsett did not play in this one.
Nice game for Swain too, but this was one of the few situations from the game. I mean, you look at it and you're like, what was the smoke and mirrors at play here, right? If we're Seahawks fans, we're just like, what can go wrong? What actually went wrong about this game? What's going to stop us from being excited? And a lot of times it's just like, well, you know, they got 3 or 4 lucky interceptions or whatever. There wasn't that much luck at bay in this game. There was the fumble that David Moore picked up. And then there was this one. Those were the only two real plays where it's like, they got lucky in that one. I don't think that makes up for a 13-point difference, though.
No, I mean, that was a fumbled handoff when it was on an end around to David Moore. So those, I think, tend to be recovered by the offense pretty frequently, right?
I think given the position, that's probably right. The recovering the fumble on the punt was probably lucky, and like expecting the other team to go 0-for-4 on fourth downs, like that's also not something that will be repeatable, but it got them the win today, so that's good enough for now.
You could also say, I think they probably came up on the fortunate end of the pass interference calls in this one. Like,
yep.
The Tyler Lockett one was going to be hard not for them not to give that, but there was a couple times where Quandre Diggs, you know, in particular, arrived early and there was no flag. Something you pointed to potentially being affected by the lack of fans in the stadium at Mercedes-Benz Stadium.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine having a like normal home crowd and have plays like that, especially I think it was the Diggs one on the pass to the left where like he obviously arrived early and knocked the receiver down. And like in a normal situation, the fans are just going to start yelling for blood. And most of the time the officials are going to throw the flag. And like, that's another drive that would be kept alive. But here, like there's really, it really did not seem like the Falcons had any sort of home field advantage because there's no fans there. So that's a lot of like, at least what evidence suggests, that's a lot of what drives home field advantage. And that's now gone from almost every stadium.
The Seahawks pay that fumble off with a touchdown pass from Wilson to Greg Olsen, his first in a Seahawks uniform, where the ball was on him before he even turned around out of his break. That was a pretty amusing play.
Yeah, it seems like Wilson trusts Olsen already, which is nice. There was also that first third down conversion of the game was like Wilson got the ball out right away to Olsen, who picked up the first down. So if they're able to get production out of Olsen on these key third down or red zone plays, then maybe the contract won't look so bad after all.
A pretty crucial stop for the Seahawks following that. Obviously, they've made it a minimum two-score game, really more than that, because it was two touchdowns and two-point conversions. Atlanta gets a 44-yard pass to Julio Jones. Was that that was the play where Shaquille Griffin got picked off? No, maybe not. I guess that was a different one.
Touchdown.
Oh, right. You're right. And moves it deep into Seahawks territory. They come up 3rd and 2 at the Seahawks 11. Todd Gurley for no gain. Jamal Adams again making a play on that one, co-credited with Bruce Irvin on the tackle. And then 4th and 2, Benson Mayoa blows up a play and sacks Matt Ryan for a 9-yard loss to stop the threat.
And how have we gone this long without talking about Jamal Adams? I mean, this performance was one of the more exciting defensive performances we've seen in a long time. Just having somebody who was all over the field. You know, when we talked about what Jamal Adams could be after trading for him, it was basically like, he's not Cam Chancellor, he's not Earl Thomas, he's everything all at once, and he's a good pass rusher. And that's precisely what we saw on the field from Jamal Adams. It felt like he was in on almost every single defensive play, a bunch of tackles that were cleaned up. There was a pass later on in the game that was completed to Julio Jones. And I said, this is one. And Adams like made the initial hit and then stuck with it and made the tackle by grabbing Julio's feet. And it was like, this is one that they might have missed last year. This might have been a first down without Jamal Adams being there. He kind of can do everything and is extremely fast. Like, it was thrilling to watch Jamal Adams play defense.
Yeah, he's everything that people said he would be, and like he must be so happy to be on the Seahawks and not the Jets now. So I'm sure that that also helped bring some energy. But he's like, I'm always skeptical of people talking about like bringing energy or juice or whatever people call it, but today watching Jamal Adams, like he was everywhere, and like you could tell the impact he had on this defense, even though the defense was oftentimes not very good, but Adams was.
Yeah, it was kind of a boom or bust defensive performance, I think. The Seahawks on the subsequent drive there nearly managed to pick up a 2nd and 29 created by back-to-back full starts and then a holding on Davion Lewis, his second of those three penalties. A 10-yard completion to Tyler Lockett on 2nd and 29, and then Freddie Swain gets his first career catch on 3rd and 19 for 17 yards. in a situation where they can make it a clear three possession game. This time, Pete Carroll kicks the field goal on 4th and 2 and makes it a 31-12 lead for the Seahawks. After that is when we had the Atlanta touchdown to Calvin Ridley. That was the play where Shaquille Griffin got picked off by Jamal Adams unintentionally. Seahawks stopped the two-point conversion to give themselves a shot at Scorigami. That was one of the disappointing outcomes of the game. Now, here was the most 2019 Seahawks drive of the entire game. Leading 31-18 with 9:29 left in the game as they take over. Chris Carson for minus 3 yards. Russell Wilson passed to Greg Olsen for 4 yards. Russell Wilson incomplete to DK Metcalf. Punt, you've taken a minute 40 off the clock and done nothing to advance the ball.
Yeah, this is when I was starting to get a little bit nervous, because if the Falcons had scored here, then the Seahawks would be up by, I think, 6 points with 5 minutes left or something. So there'd be a lot of pressure on the offense to succeed, but luckily the Falcons did not.
Yeah, defense again stepping up at a key moment. Falcons drive it to the Seahawks 35, but then three consecutive Matt Ryan incompletions, including to Kelvin Ridley on both 3rd and 4th down. And the Seahawks get aggressive after they get the ball back with 6 minutes 11 seconds and a 13-point lead. A 37-yard completion to DK Metcalf, and a drive that then an 18-yard completion to David Moore that takes them down to the 2, where finally Carlos Hyde in his Seahawks debut gets into the end zone for a 38-18 Seahawks lead and effectively ending the meaningful portion of this game. I would say that one of my big concerns here, though, was the Seahawks need some work. Clearly did not do enough during training camp on their onside kick recovery, because they were not ready for Younghoe Koo.
Nobody's ready for Younghoe Koo.
That may be true.
This is an anomaly. As long as they don't face Younghoe Koo again, they'll be fine with onside kick recovery. I mean, you remember what he did on Thanksgiving last year.
I do, yes. It is his specialty. Generally, how are we feeling about the defense coming out of this game? Because for the second consecutive trip to Atlanta, they allowed a quarterback named Matt to throw for over 400 yards against them, but in a victory. This one felt a little better, I think, than Matt Schaub just carving up the defense in the second half last year. But, you know, they're definitely – the coverage is a concern.
Yeah, I think they probably played about – what I thought they would be. They don't have a pass rush, really. And against a team with a very good quarterback and elite wide receivers, then it's going to be pretty hard to stop them. And I think we saw a lot of that. But this version of the Seahawks is, like, they have a franchise quarterback who's one of the best quarterbacks in the game. So it's going to be up to the defense to just, like, be sort of average, I guess.
I mean, this could be a top 10 Falcons offense. Like, obviously, we don't know how good they're going to be this year, but I think we all expect this Falcons offense to be good. Like, and a lot of these yards were in garbage time. I personally come out of this game feeling pretty good about the defense. You know, like, this could be one of the better offenses they face. Also, Matt Ryan always does this to the Seahawks. Like, his level of comfort with the Seahawks base defense is... Yep. So high. So it's like, I just don't think you can take too much from that, and especially with how much of it came in garbage time. Like, this was still a relatively good performance.
I don't buy that much of it came in garbage time. They had, after the Seahawks went up 31-12, if you wanted to find that as garbage time, they had 150, 185, 200 yards. Presumably most of that was passing. That still means Matt Ryan had 250 yards through basically the third quarter.
How about this?
Early in the fourth.
Matt Schaub did it last year. If it's Matt Ryan, you're going to feel a lot better than if it's Matt Schaub.
I mean, I agree with that.
I don't think we should expect this season having quarterbacks who probably should be retired roasting the Seahawks.
Yeah, next week it'll actually be an interesting test, because the Patriots offense is probably not going to be very good, and it's also not in a dome. So, like, if the Seahawks defense has potential to be good, then we should expect them to have much better performance last week before it gets really hard in week 3 against the Cowboys.
nowhere near the level of weapons. Also, a quarterback who has a very high degree of comfort with the Seattle's defense.
Yeah, weeks 1 and 2, it's the quarterbacks outside the NFC West that they've faced the most ever. I assume it's going to be a classic Carolina Seattle game, even though Cam is no longer in Carolina. That's my working assumption.
Oh, I think the Cardinals just scored again.
Yes, so. as an update. The Cardinals gave up a touchdown. They gave up a touchdown to the 49ers and went down 3, and DeAndre Hopkins took it.
34-yard touchdown pass, DeAndre Hopkins. Thank you.
We'll see. This one was close. They haven't kicked the extra point yet. There's a chance that he was down at the 1, but DeAndre Hopkins is having such a monster PPR game.
I'm not excited about facing DeAndre Hopkins twice each season going forward.
I think we're rooting for Arizona, right? Because they're probably less threatening.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
We also just don't like the 49ers. He's at 14 receptions right now, DeAndre Hopkins.
Is there anyone else we haven't talked about yet that we should get to? I mean, we've barely talked about Tyler Lockett, who had 8 catches for 92 yards on 8 targets. 8 for 8 for 92. That's a pretty nice little line.
The only incompletions of the game came to DK Metcalf.
Which is a little unfair, because, again, 2 of those were tips. He had zero control over them.
Well, he dropped 1, and there was another one that sort of, like, went to his feet. I couldn't remember the other 2, but that makes sense if they were tips, and I didn't really know who the intended receiver was. But, I mean, this is no shade against DK Metcalf, who had an excellent game. I think whatever we were looking for from DK Metcalf in year 2, like, if he's going to get 95 yards and a touchdown every game, sign us up.
Yeah, for sure. How likely do we think it is that the Seahawks continue this offensive philosophy? As Ben mentioned, you got the reward for it that you were hoping for, but that hasn't always been enough in the past. Do we think that this was situational or something they will continue?
I think, so that's a great question, and I think it's kind of hard to answer. Like, one possibility is that, like, they respect/fear the Falcons offense and knew that they would need to score points to keep up with them. So that's why they came out with that game plan, and maybe the same won't be true for the Patriots next week. So I think how they play next week might be revealing about how far they've actually come.
Has that ever been the case with the Seahawks before? Right? Like, I mean, there have been times that should have been the case, but it just doesn't feel like that's the way that they view things.
Well, they're so confident in their defense, definitely. I mean, we've talked about in the past that Pete's, like, faith in his own team is sometimes a weakness of his as coach. I think it's also telling that, look, this is the first game of the season. They've been working for months with us having zero opportunity to see any of it because of the fact that there's not been a preseason. I think it's probably telling that they operated this way in week 1 of the season, and that makes me optimistic.
Kenyon Drake right in the Cardinals touchdown, by the way.
Great.
This is about
time.
Good for you, bad for me. Well, I think it's more about the most exciting. I mean, there's so many exciting parts of this game, you know, like we went over, just how it seems like, you know, the Seahawks let the Nerds win a little bit. And I think the stark difference between some of the first games of the season that we've seen under the Seahawks, at least from the ones that I recall, right? There was the 1-point victory against the worst team in the league last year at home. There was, I think this was the previous year, the loss at Denver. Before then, there was that, like, brutal Dolphins game that Russ got hurt by Ndamukong Suh in. Like, there haven't been that many great week ones of the sort of second era of the Seahawks run, maybe even before then too. I think there were some brutal Panthers games in there in the mix. But, like, this was a week 1 where the Seahawks looked like they were in week 10.
Yeah, that's the first time that's happened since the 2014 opener, I think, the one against the Panthers where they raised the banner and all that. That was another really fun game. So
against the Packers.
Yeah, Packers. Did I say Panthers? Yeah, Packers. I'm still thinking about Cam Newton, I guess. But, yeah, it's great to not only have Seahawks football, but actually have it be enjoyable to watch right from the get-go. So it's a brave, enjoyable new world.
And not that stressful. As Tristan pointed out in the chat, and I forgot to tweet about, this would have been their second largest win of last season.
Their largest win of last season. I think I think the final score would have been their second largest win of last season.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. But they could, it, previous to the garbage time touchdown by Atlanta, yes, would have been their largest. Yeah. They only won one game by double-digit points last season, so they've already matched that total, well on their way to potentially surpassing it. All right, on that note, if you have not checked out the audio version of our live show Friday night, live Peltoncast live from home via Zoom, be sure to do so. Some of the season preview already, I guess, rendered irrelevant by us seeing that the Seahawks did, in fact, let Russ cook in this opener, but that was a lot of fun. Stay tuned. We're going to try to get some video from that up at some point if you were unable to join us like Ben wasn't. And thanks so much, Ben, for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, and I hope there's more games like this.